Hello and welcome to Volume 45 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll speculate on what the second term of the Bush administration will mean to forest landowners. We'll talk about how to make it more likely that your children will value your timberland in the same way that you do. And we'll give you some tips on making your land more attractive to wildlife. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. This conversation is taking place in November, a few weeks after the national election that resulted in the reelection of President Bush and both the House and Senate with Republican majorities. Here to discuss recent trends in Washington that have implications to forest landowners is Bill Hoover. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
I understand that recently the American Jobs Creation Act included some provisions that were helpful to timber owners. Is that true?
Yes, you've already talked about the change in the capital gains rules with regard to timber that's held primarily for sale to customers. That's certainly significant, but there's some implications from that. I assume you also talked about the deduction of reforestation expenses up to $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And did you talk about the domestic production deduction?
No, we didn't cover that, but
okay.
you're on the topic of the what they call the 631B reform. Is that right?
The 631B reform,
mm-hmm.
has the connection with that is passive loss rules, which
mm-hmm.
were not changed, and that's the next item on everybody's agenda because that's very significant with the ability to get capital gains without having to use pay-as-cut contracts for timber that's held by a business. Then there's a strong incentive to organize or structure yourself as a business, but you're subject to the passive loss rules if you're a business. So most of us understand the complications that are involved in trying to prove that you're materially participating in some of these activities because of the long time periods, in most cases, between activities on your forest land. The domestic production deduction is will eventually be a 9% of your qualified income or revenue from your business would be a write-off, and we're still trying to figure out how that's going to apply to the to timber folks, and it's an open question right now. But if that did become available, that would be very significant.
So there's still some work to do and some clarification that can be made to the existing new act, which was good news for forest landowners.
Oh, absolutely. But we really won't know how it's going to be implemented until the IRS writes regulations, and they really are going to have a big burden in trying to write regs for all the changes that have occurred.
Well, there were some significant changes in the last election, second term of the Bush administration, and then the House and the Senate. What do you think we could expect if you look in your crystal ball for the next Congress?
Well, the Congress is going to be more conservative, but that could be a plus or it could be a minus with regard to the tax rules. And I think Congress is really going to focus on deficit reduction. I do expect that the President will get the Congress to make permanent the changes that occurred in 01, the elimination of the estate tax, or the death tax, as we call it now. So I expect that Congress will pass a bill to make those things permanent. But in terms of a massive tax bill like we just saw this year, I don't expect that. I expect that there will be efforts to come up with proposals to simplify the Internal Revenue Code that the President has promised, but that's such a major undertaking that I really doubt that 4 years is long enough to get that accomplished.
Are there other things that could happen in the next 4 years that may be a little bit more intangible that the Congress can affect? For example, the improving economy and markets and that sort of thing. Do you see any changes in that area in the next few years?
Not really. Improving markets, like for southern pine timber,
mm-hmm.
and the with regard to Canadian exports,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. I have a student up in Canada right now looking at that issue, and I don't expect any major changes to occur. I think that spruce pine fir is still going to be flowing across the border,
mm-hmm.
And the movement of the industry to other parts of the world is a trend I think we're going to have to adjust to, and so maybe find an additional uses for pine that's going to is going to be the way to go.
Going to be part of the solution there. Yeah.
Yes, I'm not sure Congress is going to make any changes in that area.
Okay. Well, Dr. Hoover, we appreciate you joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for letting me talk. Bye-bye.
Our next guest is a past president of AFOA and a timber tax expert, and it's a person who's passionate about using your forest land to create a legacy for the next generation. We welcome back Henry Barclay. Hello, Henry.
Hey, Hayes. How are you doing?
I understand you've been talking with landowner groups around the country about this concept of legacy. What is all that about?
Well, our firm has served landowners since about 1916. I wasn't there.
No.
I've been involved with landowners for about 32 years, and I've watched as grandmom and granddad have saved and worked and just created a significant timber holding with the dream in mind that their grandchildren would one day relate to that land and appreciate it the way they do. It isn't unusual for the children or the grandchildren to lack the relationship, the emotion, the sense of appreciation for the land that the grandparents have had.
What do you attribute that lack of relationship to the land as the land passes down from generation to generation? What do you attribute that to?
That's a great question, Hayes. I think it's largely because the grandparents have a legacy of values for which their land holding stands. In other words, they've got hard work, delayed gratification, investment, savings, providing not just for the future but for future generations, respecting and renewing a resource, on and on and on, whatever those values are.
Mm-hmm.
They don't generally get stated in a family or transferred. And if the values and the legacies aren't transferred, it's not unusual to see the land and all that it's meant to the family be sold off or disregarded by succeeding generations.
Mm-hmm.
There's an old saying that the first generation accumulates, the second generation preserves, and the third generation spends.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do we keep that from happening? I mean, is that the rule, or can we intervene? And what I've been talking with a number of groups about is a method to know what their values are, what the legacies are, and how to work within the family to create moments together, including fun moments, to teach and pass down those values and to provide for the almost inevitable heir that really doesn't want to be involved in the land holding but who gets it with the family values and wants to participate in that.
That's so important to plan for that person who may not currently want to be involved in it.
It is, because if you don't plan for that person, you've got a bomb waiting to explode in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know how to get that family disconnected from the land holding and get it concentrated in the folks who are going to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about how all those folks can be landowners together in succeeding generations, along with the challenges of working with each other in a family and have those great family values and legacy and still have a great Thanksgiving dinner together.
Okay. Well, that's a very timely topic considering this time of the year, and thanks, Henry, for explaining your thoughts on the matter.
All right.
One of the ways to involve the next generation is to provide opportunities for them to be educated on forest management. But short of going to university and studying the topic, where can you go to take classes on forestry? Sam Jackson can tell us. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
You have been involved in a company called Forest and Range, rather a website, forestandrange.org. Tell us about that and what it provides.
Well, what forestandrange.org is a cooperative effort of several land-grant universities around the country, and we operate through the traditional Extension Service program, and we're providing online learning for landowners to educate them about different natural resource issues and topics. It's a fairly new thing for Extension, this online learning, and it does provide anytime convenience learning for landowners. They can log in from anywhere there's an internet connection and go through what we call modules. Each educational lesson is called a module, and participate in that at any time at their leisure. And we hope to keep expanding it. We've got 7 modules online now. We have 9 more in development, and we are preparing to start work on several more. So we're expanding as we go, but there's some valuable educational materials on there right now.
If you were to go to this site, could you kind of describe how the site works? Is it interactive, or are there certain options that you can click or what?
Certainly. When you first come to our site, we'll ask you to register. It's completely free, but it just gives us a way to make sure that it's being used in the right ways and that we have valuable materials on there. We'll ask you to register and create a username and password that's solely yours. And then you can log in and start participating in the modules.
Why don't you take us through one of the modules and just kind of step-by-step what you would see?
Well, one of the modules that I think is certainly applicable to the Southeast is our module called Developing a Wildlife Enterprise. And it was developed actually out of Arkansas, but it's applicable all around the Southeast. And it basically deals with helping landowners understand the options they have with wildlife on their property and how they can manage for that wildlife. And the first section of that module basically gives a good overview of the basics of wildlife. There's a great introduction to wildlife habitat management. There are species-specific sections where it reviews the habitat requirements and management of bobwhite, quail, mourning doves, waterfowl, and white-tailed deer. And then there's also a plant ID section that helps landowners identify plants that are valuable food sources for those species of wildlife. Then once a user proceeds through that section, there's an additional section on in-depth habitat management and helps landowners develop a management plan for their property, helps them identify objectives in terms of what kind of species do I want to manage for, do I want to manage for just wildlife viewing, or do I want to manage for hunting or some other recreation. It also looks at legal aspects of a wildlife enterprise. Once the landowner would develop a management plan and say they had an interest in developing a hunting lease program or offering guided hunts through their property, there's quite a legal section of that most people don't understand. Module reviews some of that.
Before we leave the topic, is there any way to determine if you've caught the information, or are there tests or other types of feedback where you can...
There are interactive exercises that help reinforce the learning, just some multiple choice quizzes and that sort of thing. And that kind of technology will allow us in the future to begin offering certificate programs for landowners through these modules as well.
Okay.
We have that on the drawing board. So.
Great. All right, Sam, thank you a lot.
Thank you for your time.
Well, deer hunting is in full swing now, and we like to offer some tips to those of you who are hunters. Grant Woods is a wildlife biologist, and we've asked him to offer us some ideas. Hello, Grant.
Good morning.
Most hunters want to see more deer. What do you think might help them do that?
You know, I commonly say deer are slaves to their gut. They have to eat an awful lot, and so finding food sources is a key to finding where the deer are going to be.
So you follow the food trail, right?
Follow the food trail, and you know, some exciting ways to do that are locate acorns if they're present in your area, if you have that hardwood component and haven't been damaged by a storm or something, or sweetness is, deer have a sweet tooth, so add some extra nitrogen to your food plot. Nitrogen converts to sugars in some forms of, or some forages, and just an extra bag of supernitrate in the corner of a food plot could really put the deer right in your zone.
Mm. You mentioned acorns, and a lot of hunters try to use acorn production as a key to their hunting enterprise, but there seems to not be a lot of acorns in some parts of the country. What has happened?
Well, you know, some parts of the South especially had a lot of storm damage this year. Those acorns were either knocked off by wind or aborted due to the damage and fell early, didn't ripen, and deer can certainly smell and or taste the difference and leave those acorns alone. A late frost is of course horrible on white oak acorns and will just destroy that crop. So it's important to, when you find acorns, pick them up, take your pocket knife, cut a couple in half, and make sure they're whole and solid and smell appropriate.
So it sounds like they are not absolutely predictable, but what factors can you use to predict their production and availability before hunting season even begins?
Right. You know, the best factor is probably the old rule of thumb. If you know a grove or an area of trees that have produced historically, those trees have, you know, just genetically have selected over time to be good producers, and they tend to repeat yourself. I guess history repeats itself. And so history is a good indication. Acorns a little higher on the ridge because we know those late frosts tend to occur in those bottoms as the cold air settles. And so ridgetops usually have more acorn production than lowlands where frost is a problem.
Where the tree's located and history, those are two keys then.
Certainly. And of course, the north side of a ridge has less solar radiation, so it retains more moisture and usually bigger and juicier acorns than the south side of a ridge.
Okay. Well, those are some good tips for the hunters among us. Thank you, Grant. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Forest pathologists are an interesting bunch. The names that they give to diseases of the tree are sometimes amusing. Anosis root and butt rot is a memorable one. But the disease that's getting a lot of attention these days has a name that says it all, sudden oak death. Here to talk about it is Scott Innebeck. Hello, Scott.
Good morning.
Why don't you tell us what sudden oak death is?
Well, sudden oak death is currently a forest disease caused by a newly described and we believe an introduced fungus, a Phytophthora species, into the west coast of California. It actually was first reported in about mid-1990s, maybe 1995, because oaks were suddenly dying. So turns out that's how it got its name, sudden oak death. And you mentioned, you know, silly names. Well, they don't. It actually takes about 1 to 2 years for the trees to die after infection. So what they were actually given the name on was the symptoms that they were observing. But it turns out it actually causes a couple of different diseases and actually potentially poses a threat to the eastern forests. It does cause a canker and kills our forest trees, especially the tan oaks, coastal live oak, California black oak. But the other thing that it does, and we believe this is how it got spread around and is moving, is that it also causes a leaf blight, you know, maybe leaf spots, or a twig blight on landscape species that get moved around, like camellia and rhododendron. So what we think happened is that the fungus was introduced on maybe some landscape stock, got established in a nursery in California, and then landowners and landscape people went out and purchased these rhododendrons and camellias, and they put them in their yards. And then the fungus built up populations and doesn't really harm these rhododendrons and camellias, but it got established and the populations built up, and then it jumped over to the forest trees.
What is the status now of the disease? You said it began in 95, I think you said in the West Coast.
Right. Right now the disease is established in, I think it's 14 West Coast counties, the counties in Western California along the coast. And those counties are what we would consider regulated. Animal Plant Health Inspection Service regulates the movement of bark and firewood and plant material. And we've pretty much got an idea of what the conditions necessary for disease. And they've done a host, they've looked at the hosts that we have out east. And we have a lot of the similar hosts. We have the red oak groups. We have the rhododendron. We have the mountain laurel. We have the vacciniums, the blueberries. So we have the hosts, and we have the environment to, you know, favor the disease. And actually, the U.S. Forest Service has done a really good job at mapping risks. And the entire Appalachian region from, you know, let's say, Birmingham north to, New York, you know, North Carolina, the Appalachian region would be considered high to moderate risk, as well as the coastal areas, Mobile and Biloxi, because of the live oak population.
Well, we're at risk, but I was curious about what a landowner could do to try to lessen the likelihood that they would get this.
Well, right now the greatest risk is the movement of infected plant material from the West Coast to the East Coast. And there are many nurseries that ship, let's say, camellias or rhododendrons from, you know, they produce them in the California and then ship them east. So right now it's regulated. So a nursery, you know, produces this material, needs to, you know, make sure they have a disease-free certification. Unfortunately, this past March, a nursery in a county that wasn't regulated shipped a considerable amount of material east, and many, many states received infected material.
Mm-hmm.
That material was immediately destroyed, stock sale destroyed. So we, you know, let's say we dodged a bullet there.
All right. Okay.
Right now, it's mostly an educational thing. Master gardeners, need to be aware of what the signs and symptoms are on the, let's say, the herbaceous material, the rhododendrons, so that we don't move this material from the nurseries into the forest settings.
And, okay.
And that's our biggest risk, is to get it established in an urban setting, and then it, you know, the fear is that it move out into the forest settings.
Okay. Thanks, God, for highlighting that topic. We appreciate it. Most people recognize that it's important to thin your trees at some point during the rotation, but it's oftentimes easier said than done. We'd like to talk to Dennis LeBlue of F&W Forestry about the best way to do a good job. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Hayes. How are you?
Is there still some reasons to mark trees that are supposed to be selected for cutting?
Yes, we do a lot of selective thinning for various reasons. The main thing you're doing out there is you're controlling the density of your stand to improve the health of your stand and grow value out there. We do thinnings for a lot of reasons. We also do a lot of seed tree type cuts for natural regeneration, do improvement cuts in hardwood stands and natural pine stands. But probably the most thinning is done on in plantation settings, so controlling the density and trying to leave the best crop trees out there for the future.
When you go about doing that, are there advantages and disadvantages to marking it with paint or whatever versus doing what's called operator select?
There really is some advantages. There are some disadvantages. It's obvious in when you're dealing with higher value products such as your saw timber and quality hardwoods that selection process becomes very important. But even in a first thinning situation, which is where people are most likely to use an operator select, there are some real advantages to doing the thinning with the marking. What you run into is an operator out there. He's looking at he really has somewhat of a conflict of interest in marking timber or in his selection out there, because he's very much production oriented.
He's after weight, right? He wants weight.
That's right, and he's interested sometimes in filling out a load at the end of the day, and he may cut some larger trees that really are trees that should be left, or he's in a situation where his pulpwood quota has run out for the week, and he may want to make another load or two, and can do this with chip and saw, and he could add a few loads that way, or it may be just convenient. He's in this big machine here, and it may be convenient to cut a few trees out of the way and maneuver better, which affects your spacing and the crop trees that you leave at the end. He also is a situation where he's confined in this cab, and he really can't get out and look around at the trees like a forester would be able to see the tops and the other sides of the trees. And he may not really know what the landowner's objectives for the property are, what he's trying to accomplish out there, or have the formal training.
Well, those are some of the considerations in actually marking or operator select. But why is it worth the cost to, I mean, what you're doing is you're marking trees that have lower value. I mean, is there a point to that?
There really is. It's not what you're getting out of the thinning, per se, as far as your income or even the expense that it would cost you. The economic analysis shows that the important issues in your rate of return on your investment is what you paid to start with, what your establishment costs are at the beginning, and really what you get on that final harvest at the end.
So it's protecting what you're leaving behind.
That's right. The thinning in between the whatever cost you spend, or whether you get $3 a ton for your product or $12 for a ton, it really matters very little on the far end.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Dennis. Our final guest is Dr. Kenneth McDicken, and we invited him to talk about some new technologies that are related to aerial photography. Hello, Kenneth.
Good morning.
Your company is doing some 3D technology. Can you describe what that is?
You bet. We work a lot on high-resolution aerial digital photography, so we use a digital camera rather than a film camera. We have a package of equipment that fits on just about any small aircraft, usually Cessna 172s to Cessna 207s, in that range. the digital imagery bypasses all of the handling of print film. Although, of course, you can print these photos if you'd like. Mm-hmm. But one of the big advantages is that it allows us anybody to take a look at these images in three dimensions. So you see them in 3D. You can see stands and stand heights and all those things.
That's what I was going to ask you. How is that useful, being able to see it in 3D as opposed to other methods?
Now, we think we see a lot more detail in the stand, and it allows us to do more in virtually every area of planning and management that uses remote sensing or aerial photography. From stand improvement, allows you to better identify areas for thinning or for fertilization, for harvest and road planning. Forest health, we think we get a substantial amount of additional information by being able to look at these images in 3D than we do it just at 2D flat images. We can do inventory estimates, and it provides a good map base.
Is it expensive?
It's not so expensive at the larger scale, but it's all dependent on what the scale is and the product type that one wants. It can be as cheap as 10 cents an acre. If we're flying 500,000 acres, we can bring it down to 10 cents.
When you say scale, what does that mean?
It means how much of an area we fly in on a particular job. So if we're flying just for a day and all the mobilization costs are incorporated, we're probably up around, I'd say, a minimum of $1 or $2 an acre. If we're flying a large tract or a series of tracts that are done at the same time, we can bring the cost down to certainly less than 50 cents an acre. In the extreme, probably the cheapest we could do would be around 10 cents an acre.
It'd be an advantage then to the forest landowner to group together with other landowners and try to drive those costs down?
You bet. We're working with a couple of different owners in different states to try and do that. It takes a fair amount of coordination, but I think it can be done, because the flight time for us isn't the most expensive part. It's doing all of the processing and getting all of the people grouped together and kind of on the same page.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Kenneth. Appreciate you joining us. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Bill Hoover, Henry Barclay, and Sam Jackson. And we also appreciate the contributions of Grant Wood, Scott Inneback, Dennis LeBlue, and Kenneth McDicken. Passing your forest land to the next generation and imparting your love of the land to your children is a lot like explaining the birds and the bees. If you wait till your children are grown, married, and have children of their own, it's probably too late. The annual meeting of the Alabama Forest Owners Association focuses on this topic. Not sex education, but rather creating a legacy out of your forest land. Be sure and join us in April of 2005 and discover the secrets of successfully passing your forest land to your children. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.